Today's high 29 with winds up to 20 miles per hour. Tonight, cloudy, very cold, the low is 7 above. Tomorrow, cloudy and windy, scattered flurries. Tomorrow's high 23 with winds up to 20 miles per hour. And then into the deep freeze for Friday. Friday's high 1 above, wind chills between 20 and 30 below. This morning, 28 degrees Kenosha, 26 in Racine, wind northwest at 6. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We spend the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show talking about silence. Silence in ways beyond how we might normally think of the word, if we think very much at all about the word silence. The title of the book we're going to be discussing is Silence in the Age of Noise. And it is written by an extraordinary Norwegian by the name of Erling Kagge, who has accomplished much more in his life than most of us could ever even dream of. He has walked to the South Pole. He has walked to the North Pole. He has climbed to the summit of Mount Everest and done other exploration as well. And along the way, he has learned a great deal about silence. But his new book, Silence in the Age of Noise, is not just about the silence one experiences when you're walking across Antarctica. It is also about the silence that is necessary for all of us in our day-to-day lives, even if we are living lives in which we are seemingly surrounded by unavoidable noise. It is about silence that helps us know who we are and what life is all about. It's a beautifully written book, very, very thoughtful and intriguing, published by Pantheon, again titled Silence in the Age of Noise. And Erling Kagge, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to this very much. You are speaking to us from Norway. And as a matter of fact, you mention at one point that you find yourself challenged, as most of us do, to find the right kind of silence. And you say it's especially true when you are in Oslo, where apparently you, I'm not sure if that's where you live, but it sounds like that's where you work. And Oslo is just like any other city and a place where silence can be sometimes a scarce commodity. Tell us more about how you look for silence, even in the midst of a busy working day in a place like Oslo.
It's a challenge for sure in daily life. I did these expeditions, as you mentioned, like walking to the South Pole with 50 days and nights under the midnight sun. In total solitude, no radio contact, no people to see, no wildlife. And that expedition taught me a lot about silence. And somehow, the more quiet I was, the more I heard. But late in life, I got a job here in Oslo, as I said, and I got eventually 3 teenage daughters. And my life suddenly was all about noise. And of course, when I think about noise, I'm not thinking about necessarily sounds, but more like all these expectations and distractions from smartphones and other devices, and you know, telephones buzzing, cars passing, televisions, etc. And to escape it, you know, you need to make a little choice, because noise is always more tempting and easier to achieve than silence. So, but I find silence in daily life, when I wake up in the morning, I have this inner silence, which I think is the most important. When I make breakfast for my kids, I have some inner silence. When I walk to the metro station, I walk to my office, I find some silence. Taking a shower, cooking, and definitely when I do the dishes, nobody is disturbing me, and I find some inner silence.
And you explore the beauty of silence in so many different ways. I want to make sure, however, that I acknowledge something in your book that I would hate for us to run out of time and not have a chance to talk about this. I appreciate the fact that your book is mostly about the beauty of silence and, let's say, the health of silence or the benefit of silence. But you also mention at one point in your book that silence can be boring. And silence is sometimes a sign of loneliness or sorrow. In other words, silence is sometimes something that can be unpleasant or that we are experiencing for the unhappiest of reasons. Can you talk a moment about that reality of silence, that silence is in and of itself not always a joyous thing we should necessarily welcome?
No, certainly, I agree. And I remember as a kid, when I had no one to play with, or if I was sad, lonely, left out, silence was all, you know, was only a negative thing. And if I look at my youngest daughter today, silence for her is, you know, it's combined with sadness. And also later in life, of course, if something terrible happens, you get turned silent. But the silence I searched for when I wrote the book is this positive silence, a silence which is rich in itself, which is a quality, you know, something exclusive and luxurious and could be a key to unlock new ways of thinking. And that's the silence that we are kind of missing out of, I think, in today's society, because it's so much noise. And there's so much more noise today than it was 5 or 10 years ago. So, and for me, sometimes I'm Googling, I find what I'm searching for, and 20 minutes later, I'm still Googling or checking the news 5 times in 1 hour, although I know nothing has happened. That's very sad because, you know, that creates loneliness in society, it creates depression, and it takes us humans apart from each other. So all these apps were supposed to bring us together, but unfortunately, the opposite is happening.
Right. And you've just touched on something that I think is so important that, and it helps me understand something you say in the book when you say sound is not only sound. And by that, I think now what you mean is that, for instance, when somebody is sitting in front of one's computer screen and you're not talking and no one else is talking, nothing else is going on in the room, and no sound is coming out of your laptop, and yet by persistently Googling this and Googling that and checking that website and so on, even though you're in a sense doing it in silence, that is not the silence that you are talking about. That even when we are looking at information and reading something off of a screen, that is not silence, and that is not the kind of silence that we need to seek.
Exactly, because I think about that as noise, and you can even, you know, go way out into the woods, and it's absolutely quiet surroundings, but you can still be thinking so much, being worried about so many things, and when you're worried, you think worried, or you're thinking about the past or the future, and that could be noise. And of course, also when you look into your computer, as you say, and waiting for a message, waiting for a confirmation, or you're distracted by something else, that's also noise. And when I looked at my teenage daughters, I kind of understood that silence in their lives almost extinct. That, you know, they hardly knew what silence is. That creates a kind of unbelievable boredom. And somehow when I looked at them, you know, and also at my friends and sometimes myself, that, you know, the more you try desperately to avoid boredom, the more bored you get.
Mm. We're speaking with Norwegian author and explorer Erling Kagge about his book Silence in the Age of Noise. Erling Kagge has explored silence and its beauty and the challenge of finding noise in our busy world, and has written this very, very thoughtful book about it. You mentioned boredom, so let's talk about boredom. And one of the most intriguing observations you make about our tendency to maybe avoid silence, to have trouble with just being quiet and silent, is, although a very acute problem now, given the way in technology intrudes on our lives all the time, that this is actually not a completely new phenomenon, and that people were writing about essentially the same problem centuries ago. Tell our listeners more about this, about some of the early writers who were exploring this theme, albeit in maybe a slightly different way.
Yes, Greg, I think that's a very interesting thing I found when I was searching, you know, for researching for my book on silence. That, like in 1640s, this French philosopher Blaise Pascal, he wrote that man is not able to sit alone in a room doing nothing, at least not for more than, you know, 10 or 15 minutes. And then instead of doing nothing, he will always do something. And that's the beginning of all his problems. And of course, then it was really difficult 350 years ago to relate to yourself in silence. But today it's much more difficult because it's so many more choices, so many more alternatives, so many more temptations that it was in the 1640s in France. But his point is still very valid, that we're not able not to do anything. We need to do something. And I think that's, you know, that's a major source for many of the problems the world is suffering today.
Hmm. In that same chapter where you talk about the writing of Blaise Pascal, you talk about how that difficulty that he was writing about so many, many years ago, almost 400 years ago, is speaking to something that is intrinsic in the way that we are made. You write at one point, this disquiet that we feel has been with us since the beginning. It is our natural state. I find that really intriguing because I think a lot of people who might pause to kind of think about this a little bit kind of assume the opposite, that we were, in a sense, created to be in this blissful state of silence, but then the modern world came along and kind of disrupted and destroyed all that. But in fact, you're saying that this is actually part of who we are, which is not to say that we should give in to it and allow the noise to intrigue, but it means it's all the more important for us to, in a sense, seek out silence consciously and to really understand it, because in a sense, it runs counter to the way that we are wired. Am I summarizing your feelings correctly there?
Yeah, I think that's yes, you're doing probably better than me, so keep on. But I think it's to start with, we have some kind of chaos in our heads, and we need to sort it out. And the way to sort it out is to have some silence. And I don't think you need to have, you know, silence like I had when I walked to the South Pole. I'm not anti-technology. I think technology has many good sides, and I'm definitely not anti-social. I think we're born to be with other people, but it's just too tempting to keep on, you know, living through other people and living through other devices and living through everything but ourselves. And that's what I was thinking about, and I think that's a natural state of being. And then, but that's all about forgetting yourself. It's all about getting the feeling that life is short, while if you turn around and try to search for the silence within every now and then, life will feel long. It will feel much richer. It's definitely not about turning you back to your surroundings and living a more egocentric life. I think silence is very much about opening up, seeing people in a different way, and loving the earth even more.
The book also features plenty of other quotations, including one from the very gifted writer David Foster Wallace, who at one point explores the topic of boredom in intriguing fashion, and proposes the possibility that we should try to be unborable, that is, incapable of experiencing boredom if we're really alive to what is around us. And you actually, although I think you agree with much of what David Foster Wallace has to say, you're not certain about that, I think. You wonder, actually, if in fact a little bit of boredom in our lives is healthy and something we should learn to accept and, in a sense, be comfortable with. Can you talk more about the usefulness of boredom?
Yes, I think, you know, when I was a kid and I was bored, and I kind of felt this, had this desperate feeling that something exciting should happen. My mother told me, Erling, it's healthy to be born every now and then. And I felt that was proper bullshit. I didn't believe it. But today, when I'm 55, 56 years old, I look at my daughters and look around and also, you know, look at myself. I think, you know, we should have some more boredom. We should have some more boredom from having nothing to do. I think today people are bored because they have too many things to do. It's too many options, too many things going on, too many TV series, too much on TV, too many news. And we're just bored because we're not able to stop and think and listen to ourselves. So I believe actually this kind of old-fashioned boredom that you have kind of sit down doing nothing, and after a while, maybe a few seconds or minutes, you will hopefully calm down and empty your head a little bit, not thinking too much, and that's when you will experience this inner silence.
Hmm. It's interesting. At another point in the book, when you're talking about boredom and how we sometimes think of boredom and are frightened of boredom or frightened of being bored, you say that for many people experiencing boredom gives them the feeling of being held captive. And that is such an interesting idea. And perhaps people who are afraid of silence might fear it being the same way, that when you are, in a sense, willingly placing yourself in a situation of absolute silence, that you are, in a sense, imprisoning yourself. And you, of course, have experienced boredom, or a silence, I should say, to be just the opposite. You have experienced silence as an entirely liberating experience.
Yes, certainly. Of course, on expeditions into the wilderness, or just, you know, going into the woods outside Oslo, I do. But also in my daily life, I think, you know, it's if you're going to live a fairly free life, be a free human being, you need silence. Because if you always choose the easiest option in life, which is noise, then it's kind of predetermined what you're going to do. And that's, you know, that's sad, because you have this huge one opportunity to live a rich and great life, and then you're wasting it by running away from yourself and living through all the daily noise which is surrounding us. So to me, yes, freedom is a bit complicated. It has a higher threshold to venture into than noise. But it gives you this great feeling of freedom, and it reminds you that we are all born explorers, and we should keep on exploring.
Hmm. We're speaking with Erling Kagge about his new book called Silence in the Age of Noise. As I mentioned in the introduction, and as I think you've touched on once or twice, you are not only a gifted writer, but also an intrepid explorer. And your explorations have taken you to the South Pole, to the North Pole, and to the summit of Mount Everest. I want to give you an opportunity to talk specifically about what it was like to reach the South Pole by yourself, and about how Antarctica was, in your estimation, the quietest place you have ever been. Tell us more about just how quiet Antarctica was and the kind of silence that you experienced while traversing it on the way to the South Pole.
Yeah, Antarctica is certainly the quietest place on Earth, and it's also the windiest and the coldest place on Earth. And no sounds, man-made human sounds. I was left in almost total silence. So when I stopped skiing and rested on my ski poles, it was so silent that I could both hear and feel the silence. While back home, it's so much noise, over the car passing, a telephone buzzing, so I can hardly hear the noise at all. And what was interesting, when I walked into this huge white nothingness, after days and weeks pass by, you get this feeling that you become a part of the nature, that your body doesn't stop by your fingertips, but it kind of extended into the nature. And also, when I started, I felt that everything was flat and white all the way to the horizon. But as the time passed by, I started to see some more details. It's a bit pinkish, yellowish, bluish in the ice and the snow. And it wasn't totally flat either. And somehow I could send some ideas out into the nature and get some other thoughts back again. So I had a kind of a dialogue with the nature. And somehow, you know, I felt that Antarctica was changing while I was walking down there. But, you know, but then I understood Antarctica was still the same Antarctica, but I was the one who changed. And I kind of became hyper-aware to silence and very much, you know, a part of everything surrounding me. And that was a great feeling. And that learned me a lesson about silence, which is enriching me to this day, and that's also why, you know, part of why I want to write a book about it. After 50 days and nights, I got to the South Pole. I dragged everything I needed on a little sled, or big sled. And the Americans had built a base at the South Pole, and since I didn't have a radio, nobody expected me. So I came walking into the pole, was met. Everybody was very surprised, the scientists. And the first thing someone said to me was, "How do you do?" And just like I should have met them on the street. And I said, "Like a pig in shit," because I have had the same underwear on for 50 days and nights. But then, you know, you get home after a few weeks, and then it's noise again, and you get back to daily life, and you have to pay your bills, and when the washing machine breaks down, you need to have it repaired. To get back to daily life again pretty quickly. But as an experience, it's life-changing.
Right. And I should think that one of the most extraordinary things about it was the fact that here you were in what you call the quietest place on Earth. So you have this incredible silence around you, this outward silence like you had never experienced before or perhaps since. And yet, your book is mostly about the importance of inner silence, the silence within us. You call that the most interesting kind of silence. How are the two related? Does outward silence automatically create this inner silence you're talking about, or are they not connected in the same way at all?
I think, you know, to your first question is, you can be way out into Antarctica, and it's quiet surroundings, but you can still have so much noise in your head that you're still stressed and that you're not managing to relax. But I think it's to find this inner silence, which is there all the time inside you, me, and everybody, and it's waiting for you. It's easier, I think, if there's less noise surrounding you. But I think you can find, I don't think, I know, you know, I can find it anywhere. I can even, you know, find the busiest street in New York City. I can find some inner silence. It's a bit more difficult, but it's far, far from impossible. Then you get this kind of feeling that your brain is wider than the sky. That's what you kind of, you know, start to feel when you dig into your own silence. And it's, you know, it's not complicated at all. So I think, you know, what I'm writing about is something people have been talking about for and advising people to explore for thousands of years. And I think, you know, any advice that had lasted for more than 1,000 years, we should take seriously. While advices that have lasted for 3 months, we don't need to listen to, I think.
Hmm. Do you have time for a couple of more questions?
I have a flight in 25 minutes.
All right.
Just go on for 3 or 4 minutes.
Couple more. Thank you so much. You mentioned briefly in the book that you were severely dyslexic, at least as a child. I don't know if that's still an issue with which you contend, but do you have some sense of what role, if any, your dyslexia played in your understanding of silence and your hunger for silence and your appreciation of it?
Yeah, I think to be dyslexic, I don't want to be romantic about it because it was brutal. I was bullied because of it. I was a loser in school for years because of it. And even in high school, I was struggling. So that was tough, but it also taught me a lesson about, you know, not listening too much to authorities because what the teacher told me didn't work necessarily for me. And it's also to make your brain, you know, make detours to come to the same results as the other students or pupils. But also, thirdly, I think, it taught me a lesson about silence because I was left to myself and had to think and had to, try to understand myself better because there was something in my brain or mind that didn't work properly. Mm. So it's tough to be dyslexic, but I think, in retrospect, I think it was also an advantage because, quite often I see if people had it too easy in their lives early on, throughout their youth, it's not good for them later in life because they think life is easy and life is really complicated if you're dyslexic, but also if you're not dyslexic.
Exactly. I should also say that your book, although it is beautiful and in some ways quite philosophical sort of in its flavor, is also a book full of intriguing surprises, such as when you share about talking with the entrepreneur Elon Musk, who many of us have heard of. Just briefly touch on what Elon Musk has to say about the importance of silence in his life and in his work.
You know, I have the pleasure of knowing Elon, and I wanted to ask him about silence because I think, to come up with all these unbelievable ideas, also have the talent for succeeding with Tesla and many other of his projects, you need inner silence. You need to think. You need to be by yourself. You need to kind of digest what you hear other people are telling you, and then you need inner silence. But I don't think Elon, is thinking too much about it because his life is also so much about noise. But if it hadn't been for his inner silence, he would not come up with, Tesla. He would not come up with SpaceX, getting ideas about traveling to Mars. He would not, think about making a tunnel under L.A. to, be able to drive through the city. All these ideas, they come up in inner silence.
Your book touches on many other things, including music and poetry and religion, and even on the importance of the beautiful starry sky that we sometimes see, although you point out that you are much more likely to be able to take in the full beauty of the starry sky in a place like Norway than we are here in the United States, where there is, in a sense, too much light, man-made light, to that obscures the beauty of the starry sky above us. That and so much more, but mostly your profound thoughts about the importance of silence. Your book, Silence in the Age of Noise, is published by Pantheon. Erland Kaga, I so appreciate this opportunity to speak with you about your remarkable book. Thank you so much, and very best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg.
The time is 8:40, and you're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I thought it would be fun, since a lot of people, including me, have enjoyed a new film called Mary Poppins Returns, to play from the archives an interview that touches on the figure of Mary Poppins, at least in sort of a peripheral way. This morning show interview first aired way back in 2006 at the time of the publication of a really interesting book called Searching for Mary Poppins. Women write about the intense relationship between mothers and nannies. The subtitle pretty much spells out what this book is about. Women who employ nannies to care for their children write about that experience, what it is like, what makes it warm and wonderful, what sometimes makes it a relationship fraught with all kinds of complications and difficulties. It's one of the most interesting books I remember ever reading, and so it is with some pleasure that I want to turn back to this interview and replay it for you now. The author is Susan Davis. The book is published by Hudson Street Press. Again, it's titled Searching for Mary Poppins, Women Write About the Intense Relationship Between Mothers and Nannies. Let's listen to Susan Davis explain the title of the book.
The title of the book, Searching for Mary Poppins, actually comes from the fact that nearly every one of the writers in the book mentions Mary Poppins. It's a way into the topic. And Searching for Mary Poppins actually comes from the fact that nearly every one of the writers in the book mentions Mary Poppins. It's a way into the topic. And they all say, all I knew from nannies, all I knew about nannies, I learned from Mary Poppins. I never had one. I never really saw one. My friends didn't have one. Most of the women in the book grew up not in a class where nannies were all around. And a lot of these women, nanny is a catchword for babysitter in your home. So some of these women, their nanny's only there 10 hours a week or 12 hours a week. Some of these women share the nanny. But for us, the criteria was another woman, and usually it's a woman. There is an essay in the book about a manny, a young man. But it's really, the criteria was another woman coming into your home, your intimate space, to take care of your children.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned that for many of these women, Mary Poppins was maybe the image that popped in their mind, and
sure.
and many of them didn't have nannies as they themselves were growing up.
Right.
But someone, maybe more than one writer, mentions the fact that even if they did, a generation ago, the image of who a nanny was likely to be was so different from who that kind of woman is now.
Now, exactly. There is one writer in the book, Daphne Merkin. She contributes regularly to the New York Times Sunday Magazine and to the New Yorker. She was raised by a nanny, and it was actually a pretty terrible experience. And for her, she has very few memories of her mother and her nanny being in the same place at the same time. So that she, even though she was raised with a nanny in her life, she too has very few models for how it's done, how you be a nanny's boss. Because when she was with her mother, the nanny wasn't there. When she was with the nanny, her mother wasn't there, and she didn't see them interact very often. And she didn't care for how she was raised by the nanny. She didn't think she was raised lovingly or well. And it was very frightening for her to go ahead and decide to hire somebody to help out with her daughter when she was a single mother and needed to work. And in those days, when Daphne was raised by a nanny, nannies were older, single, white women imported from Europe. And in the book, you'll see that nannies are from everywhere. Some of them are young white women, college students covered in tattoos. Some of them are legal and illegal immigrants from Southern, from South America and Central America and from all over Asia. Some of them are girls trying to move into the city from rural America. Some of them are young male college graduates on their way to grad school with a very bright future, you know, wanting to do a certain kind of work with children before they go. So the variety of nannies in the book is really, it was important to us that we get that variety of experience. Many of the nannies are mothers, too.
Yeah, it is it's a dizzying array of different sorts of people, and almost none of them fit that stereotypical image of a nanny that is referred to in your title. It's interesting, too. One of the cases, one of your writers talks mm-hmm. about how they just had it in their mind that they wanted a French nanny.
Right.
And that ends up being actually a rather unhappy experience, one of the more unhappy experiences described in this book.
Yeah, that's the very well-known novelist and biographer Roxana Robinson. She talks about being a young mother in the 70s, so a long time ago, and she worked at an auction house, an art auction house in New York City, and it was a fairly patrician life she was living, and she very much wanted to complete the picture. It's a romantic picture she had invented for herself about what a patrician life would be like for a young woman in New York City working in a genteel business, and she was determined that her daughter have a French nanny. And she found this woman and essentially hired her because she was French. And only later does she confess that when she called this woman's references, they weren't that great. And she sort of put that out of her mind and talked herself into this woman because she fulfilled some fantasy that Roxana had. And she wasn't a very good nanny. Part of what's interesting of that in that story, too, is the turmoil inside Roxana when she knew she had to fire this woman, and how hard it was for her as a woman to fire another woman, how she had no experience dismissing people, and the toll it took on Roxana. And we very specifically placed that essay in the book next to an essay by a woman named Alice Elliott Dark, who many years after Roxana, and let's say many years after a kind of mainstreaming of feminism and of ideas about women being empowered and in positions of authority, Alice had a very similar situation where she had a nanny who was not good, and she had proof that the nanny wasn't good, and she had to fire her. She knew she had to fire her. It was so hard. It was so hard because Alice was a woman and a mother, and she didn't want to fire this other woman who was also a mother. The responsibility that women feel in these positions of authority and being somebody's boss, those problems haven't been solved by the progress of the culture. They're still there. That part of being a working mother doesn't ever seem to go away.
We're speaking with Susan Davis, one of the editors of a book called Searching for Mary Poppins. Women write about the intense relationship between mothers and nannies. In a couple of instances in the book, this relationship, which is already going to be intense, I mean, in almost every instance, just by its very nature, in a couple of instances, this relationship is made far more intense because of something rather extraordinary occurring in that particular home. I'm thinking in particular of an essay by a woman who hires a nanny who happens to be a man at a moment in time when this woman's husband, that is, the mother's husband, is dying of some kind of rather terrible disease.
Yeah,
and the really incredible relationship that springs up in every direction from this stranger in their home. It's really amazing.
That's I'm so glad that you said that, because that essay we considered that essay long and hard. It's called In His Memory. It's by Andrea Nakayama, and she's a writer in Portland, Oregon, and it was really such a difficult story for her to tell because there were so many stories going on at once. In that, when her son was very young, her husband got very, very sick with brain cancer. Her young husband, he died at 33. And she needed help in her home to take care of her son so that she could, one, take care of her husband, and two, keep working because somebody had to keep working to keep them going financially. And she had never hired anybody to do anything in her life. She's a writer. She's always made a living as a book designer and someone who's in charge of book production. She works with contractors and vendors, but she's never hired personnel. So imagine doing that in a context so fraught with emotion, because her having anybody come into your home to do anything is intimate, but having somebody come into your home where your beloved husband is dying is, you know, even more sort of intimate. She hires a young man. She wanted to hire a young man because she was worried that her young son was losing his father figure and his male role model, and she knew that it was the start of a long life for her replacing that and making sure that there were male role models in her young son's life. And she liked the idea of, besides her, the other person who held her son and bathed him and loved him and hugged him, be a man. So she hired this young, recent college graduate who's going to go to graduate school in a few months. He was already set to go, I believe. But he shared Andrea and her husband's values, and it turned out he shared all kinds of things with Andrea's husband, Isamu, taste in music and taste in books and taste in philosophy. And a lot of time when their son was napping or their son was with Andrea, the nanny, whose name was Matthew, would spend time with Isamu, and he really became Isamu's last friend. And it's a beautiful story. Of course, it's terribly heart-wrenching because Isamu dies and Matthew also goes off. And she closes that essay with this wonderful image of how Isamu and Matthew stay alive in her son's heart and how it's possible they're confused in her son's heart because he was such a little boy.
Who was who and who was what
right.
to him? And
right. She's not sure that when he's talking about his dad, he might be actually remembering Matthew. And when he's talking about Matthew, he might be remembering his dad. And she comes to a place of peace about that it doesn't matter, really, because those were his sort of last fathers in those early stages of his life. And since then, he has an uncle, and he has role models in his life. But, yeah, that's a particularly heart-wrenching circumstance. There are some essays that have very extreme circumstances. Elizabeth Graver has a very harrowing tale of hiring a nanny who only later, after they had become very attached to the nanny, confesses that she has her own daughter the exact same age as Elizabeth's daughter, which means she's still very young, which was sort of upsetting for Elizabeth. They then let that nanny bring her daughter to work with her, and they really become a kind of family. But then that nanny, they even incorporate that nanny's mother. But then that nanny also gets involved with a man that Elizabeth and her family would not necessarily approve of, but they're not really her family, so they can't approve or disapprove of him. And he winds up causing them some tremendous anxiety. He becomes a kind of threat, a real physical threat to their family. So it gets very harrowing, when you take somebody into your home and into your life, you don't always know who else is coming with them.
Well, and another recurring theme in this book is that sort of that age-old line about you just when you think you know someone.
Right.
I mean, time and time again, these women who hire nannies and babysitters will often be surprised, and often in fairly unpleasant ways. Especially,
right.
However, in a way which in some ways seems almost naive. That is, this assumption is made that this woman that has come into your home to care for your child has a very special, strong attachment, and that they would only leave that relationship for the most serious of reasons, when in fact In many cases, that connection will be cut quite suddenly, sometimes for no apparent reason at all. And it is sometimes the ending of these relationships that is particularly difficult.
Yeah, there's a terrific essay in the book called Dumped by Pamela Kruger, where she talks about figuring out the hard way that I need to go back to my home country is the nanny version of let's just be friends. It's how a nanny breaks up with you. I think one of the most interesting things about the mom-nanny relationship, the mom-babysitter relationship, is that each side thinks the other one has all the power, and it's not for the same reasons. Moms think that the nannies have all the power because the nannies can quit on a moment's notice. The nannies can make demands about hours and pay that the moms may not be able to meet. And the nannies have in their arms all day the mom's children, their most precious children. And you want to believe that even if this woman has a squabble or a bone to pick with you, she will still always be good to your child. And mostly this is all going unsupervised. So your child is with your nanny precisely because you aren't there. And there are some other moments in the book, also in Pam Kruger's essay, where people pass on information to her, I saw your nanny. And it's, you know, those are very spine-tingling words to a mom. Because moms need their nannies to make their lives run and to get their jobs done. And nannies think that moms have all the power because moms can change the rules and they can change their demands and they can change their circumstances. And in the end, if they say the child can't eat any chocolate and they find out you've given the child chocolate, they can fire you. You know what I mean?
Well, and they can fire you for less than that. I mean, they can they can essentially fire you for absolutely no reason whatsoever.
Right. And nannies are, they're terribly unprotected. There's no union. You know, there's no collective bargaining agreement. There's no minimum wage. So
it's an enormous amount of trust which is involved in this. And, of course, you establish that trust, and then to have it shaken or even shattered is pretty bewildering.
Exactly.
I have to ask you, does it bother you at all that, in effect, this book is entirely one-sided? That is, the subtitle is Women Write About the Intense Relationship Between Mothers and Nannies, but not a single essay is by a nanny. It's all from the point of view of the mothers. I mean, it's not that I regret that it's done that way. I mean, I loved this book and found it very interesting. But in effect, it is a one-sided telling of this relationship.
Yeah, that's very, very true, and I'm glad you asked that. It does not bother me at all, only because Gina and I intended from the start only to make this book. It's not a work of investigative journalism or journalism of any kind, so that we weren't attempting to give two sides of anything. We were attempting to fully and richly represent one side, the side that we knew, the side that we had personal experience with, and the side that we had professional access to. Writers. And we turn to writers because they're good at telling stories. And the best writers articulate for the rest of us our common experiences. We wanted very much to counter the image of the nanny employing mother that came across in that best-selling novel called The Nanny Diaries.
Right.
Which is about to be released actually as a movie, and was written by two young women who had been nannies on Park Avenue. Most of the mothers in that book don't work, you know, so they're having a nanny is a different equation for
more
them
of a luxury in a sense.
Yeah, than the women in our book.
The author of this book once again is Susan Davis, and this interview dating from 2006. Is for the book Searching for Mary Poppins. Women write about the intense relationship between mothers and nannies. Tomorrow on the morning show, I look forward to a conversation with WGTD's own Troy McDonald. talking about the way in which the landscape of news has changed so dramatically, and especially the way in which we take in news and the lengths to which many news entities are going to try to secure more revenue, including engaging in some activities which involve the mining of personal information without our knowledge or permission. That's tomorrow.